for standing by. All guest lines will be on mute for the duration of today's call. Today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. Now I would like to introduce your two hosts for today's call, Mr. Kevin Lembo, State Healthcare Advocate, as well as Ms. Nancy Wyman, State Comptroller. Please begin.
Thank you. Good morning, everybody.
Morning.
Morning, everyone.
Morning.
Good morning.
So just once again, the agenda has been published for today. Are there any objections to the agenda?
No.
No.
Okay, hearing none, then we will get going. Since it's a little hard to introduce ourselves online because we can't see each other and take visual cues and take turns, I'll just run through the list of folks who are participants in the call. In no particular order, obviously, I have the State Comptroller, Nancy Wyman, and myself. Alex Hutchinson, Marie Smith, Sal Luciano, Bruce Gould, Jeff Kramer, Joe McDonough, Benita Grubbs, Estella Lopez, Margaret Flinter, Ellen Andrews, Paul Grady, and I know that Rob Zavosky is in the hearing room in Hartford. Am I forgetting anyone who's a participant in the call? Okay. Then I would move. Now, were we able to resolve, Paul, the issue with the minutes from the last meeting, from hearing notes?
Well, I didn't have a subsequent conversation with anyone. I think that, although I think that the minutes on the 15th address, I'd say, my concerns.
Okay, so you would be comfortable moving forward with the December 2nd minutes as long as we approve the December 15th minutes?
Well, I guess my only issue is that they don't reflect the conversation that took place on the 2nd, but with the understanding that they were, that we did talk about them on the 15th. I don't know how we address that procedurally, but...
Okay, so maybe what we'll do is we'll put a notation on the meeting for the 2nd, just saying that some of the discussion spilled over into the 15th and could be found there.
That'd be great.
Okay. So with that, I'll accept a motion to approve the minutes. Okay, can you say your name, please?
Nancy Wyman.
Thank you.
Sal Luciano seconds.
Sal seconds. All those in favor say aye.
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 Any opposed? Okay, moving on to agenda item number 3, I'll accept a motion. Approval?
Approve. Paul.
Paul makes the motion and second.
Bruce,
thank you. Any discussion? Changes? All right, all those in favor say aye.
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 Any opposed? Great. So now we will move on to the discussion of the draft report. Nancy, if it's okay with you, I thought maybe we'd have Anya and Stan just do a quick walkthrough, like 5 minutes, 10 minutes, and then go section by section and see if there are comments or changes.
Great.
Okay, Anya, Stan, is that okay?
That sounds good.
Absolutely.
Okay, we'll turn the floor to you then for agenda item number 4.
Okay, so I'm going to start off and just do a very brief description of the structure of the report, and then Stan's actually going to go through and hit the high points in terms of the recommendations that are included in this draft. So what we tried to do with this was both include your detailed recommendations and provide some narrative that described how you arrived at those recommendations and what kind of information you considered in developing your recommendations. So the front end of the report, in addition to providing some general background on where Sustinet came from, who you are, and what you did, provides a little bit of a summary of the relationship between Sustinet and federal health care reform, and then provides the narrative that describes the kind of information you considered, including recommendations of your advisory committees and task forces in 6 major substantive areas on which you're making recommendations. And then in each of those areas, we provide a sort of narrative summary of what your overall recommendations are. So not every detail, but a sort of sum up of what the recommendation is in that major substantive area. And there's a section dealing with coverage and cost estimates, which is a representation of the Gruber analysis. And then we cover all of the detail of your recommendations, in which we tried to capture all of the recommendations you had agreed to at your last two board meetings, as well as anything else that sort of came up in housekeeping as we wrote the report and realized we had missed some detail. What you don't have here but will be added to the final report are some appendices. Those include the full reports of your advisory committees and task forces, an explanation of Dr. Gruber's methodology for the cost and coverage estimate, and then lastly, a crosswalk that essentially goes through the Sustinet law section by section and guides people to where your recommendations are addressing the areas that you're required to address. With that, I think I'll hand it over to Stan, who's going to take you through those recommendations.
Thanks very much, Anya. I'm going to organize my remarks around the detailed recommendations that begin on page 38 of the draft report. So to begin with, in terms of governance and location, Sustinet would be, under this, under the report's proposal, your proposal would be a quasi-governmental agency modeled after CHIFA, implementing the country's best thinking about how to move forward as a state governing body, including things recommended by the Pew Center for the States, which Paul brought to our attention. There's a mistake in this section of the report in terms of dates. What it should say is that the Sustinet Authority Board would be appointed by September 1, 2011, and the authority itself would begin no later than March 1, 2012. The authority board would be appointed by the governor's legislature, stakeholder groups. A consumer advisory committee would nominate one additional voting member of the board, and while the board could appoint additional members to furnish necessary expertise, the initial appointment of the board would try to keep it as small as possible. As an interim arrangement, the Sustinet Authority would be staffed by the State Comptroller's Office, and that interim arrangement would terminate by January 1, 2013 at the very latest. The policymaking duties of the Sustinet Authority include the following. It would be directed to set binding policy for delivery system and payment reform for its covered populations, subject to various limitations. And those limitations include collective bargaining agreements, federal Medicaid law, and the need to avoid increased net expenditures of state general fund dollars without going to the legislature first. The authority board could convene necessary committees and advisory groups along the lines that the existing board has done. It would offer coverage to new populations. It would need to take necessary actions, including, for example, a feasibility study, a business plan, and obtaining a license to do the following. By calendar year 2011, as soon as possible, it would offer coverage to municipalities. Such coverage would furnish municipal employees and retirees with the same benefits that are currently offered to state employees and retirees. If approved, however, by the municipality and the authority board, a different set of benefits could be offered to a particular municipality. Before 2014, if at all possible, Sustinet would offer coverage to nonprofits and small firms, but definitely by January 1, 2014, all employers and individuals in the state would gain access to Sustinet as a new health insurance option, which would provide commercial-style benefits and would include preventive services and other things. Sustinet would work with the comptroller and DSS to encourage inclusion of cost-effective smoking cessation services, which is a recommendation from your tobacco task force. Sustinet, when it's sold in the group and individual market, would be subject to those same rules that apply to other plans in those markets, including premium variation rules. Along similar lines, when Sustinet is sold to an employer, public or private, large enough to self-insure, the Sustinet would need to take steps to prevent adverse selection. For example, Sustinet could experience rate premiums charged to such employers. Sustinet would need to maintain necessary reserves reinsurance and similar measures. Sustinet would implement multi-year action plan to achieve measurable goals related to improved services for people with chronic illness, reduced racial and ethnic disparities, increased health coverage, and assess the net would engage in efforts to educate the public, conduct outreach, and work with other state agencies to enroll eligible individuals into coverage. So those are the policymaking duties. In terms of the administrative duties of the SustaNet Authority, the Authority Board would hire an executive director who in turn would hire staff and enter into contracts, subject to the overall direction and approved budget of the Authority Board. And one additional change I think we need to make in the report would be to add a date by which this would happen. This date is included in other sections but needs to go into the detailed recommendations as well, and that would be March 1, 2012 at the very latest. The SustaNet Authority could contract with one or more insurers or others to provide administrative services. The SustaNet Authority would contract with contract with the DSS and the Comptroller's Office to cover Husky Medicaid beneficiaries, state employees and retirees. So those are the highlights of the administrative duties. In terms of healthcare delivery, I should just note that many of the recommendations for delivery system reforms and payment reforms are taken from your committee reports. So there would be reforms of healthcare delivery and payments subject to constraints that I mentioned a moment ago, collective bargaining, the need to avoid increased state-funded costs, et cetera. There would be measures implemented to address disparities, including data systems that would track racial and ethnic characteristics of consumers so that one can see whether there are patterns of disparate treatment that emerge. Payment reforms supported by available evidence. Encouragement of patient-centered medical homes with incentives for providers, support, technical support, other support, and with the goal of within a specified timetable of ensuring that all SustaNet members can access the functions provided by the patient-centered medical home. Incentives for evidence-based care, leaving room for individual treatment, for individuation of treatment for particular consumers. Incentives for providers to implement electronic health records, with an eventual requirement that SustaNet providers do so. The report does not recommend using state general fund dollars to accomplish this, but rather to draw down available federal funds, have SustaNet work in the context of broader state efforts to move towards full implementation of health information technology and to use leverage negotiating on behalf of the state's providers to obtain good prices for goods and services. Providers would need to make reports about the quality, efficiency, outcomes with an opportunity to make corrections before that data is made publicly available. Data warehouse would track utilization of services across state-covered populations. Provider price comparisons would be offered to the public to help inform consumer choice. And all of these reforms would be supported by broader legal changes that, under the report, are recommended to the General Assembly in several areas. First, scope of practice laws would be reformed so that nurse practitioners, physician assistants, and others could play the maximum appropriate role in implementing patient-centered medical homes. Second, there safe harbors would be created for malpractice liability when patients are injured because providers appropriately follow approved clinical guidelines. Patients injured in such circumstances would receive compensation, but there would be no liability attached so long as the provider was appropriately following those guidelines. Third, the recommended approach would give state agencies convening authority to bring together multiple payors and providers to plan delivery system reforms. This was a change suggested by Tom Woodruff in the Comptroller's Office to avoid potential antitrust problems so that there could be effective multi-payer collaboration. And finally, SustaNet would retain most of the cost savings that are generated by these delivery system and payment reforms. The next general area of the detailed recommendations involves expanding coverage and access. By January 1, 2014, Husky would expand to 200% of the federal poverty level for all adults, providing the same benefits, cost-sharing protections, and consumer protections that are available under current law to parents. the state would maximize available federal dollars for this population. That would mean Medicaid coverage up to 138% at the federal poverty level, basic health dollars above that threshold, and to the extent that federal basic health dollars exceed the underlying Husky costs, the excess would be used to raise payment rates for adults over 138% of the federal poverty level. That's the 2014 plan. In addition, the report asks the legislature and the state to work together to find the resources needed to increase Husky eligibility before 2014, if at all possible, ideally up to the same 185% of poverty threshold that applies to parents, extending that to childless adults. And finally, the report urges that Medicaid and Husky reimbursement gradually increase over time to Medicare levels, beginning with a budget-neutral realignment of payment rates for Medicaid and Husky, and then investing additional dollars needed to raise reimbursement, on the understanding that in some areas, for such as children, pregnant women, a benchmark other than Medicare would need to be used. The final area of the report is recommends that the legislature and the state work together to find necessary resources to make key public health investments, and these resources would include federal dollars, and they potentially could include state dollars as well, though obviously not in the short term. The public health investments would include prevention, wellness, both wellness and improving preventive care infrastructure in the community. It would also involve tobacco use and prevention, obesity prevention, expanding the state's healthcare workforce, and finally addressing racial and ethnic disparities. So with that, I will stop and turn it over to you, folks.
Great. Thank you, Anya and Stan. So what I thought we would do is I'd just like to sort of take your temperature and see if there are comments, just as a general question, and then we'll go section by section and get the comments and discuss them. So is there anyone who does not have comments? And it's okay to say yes.
Anyone who does not have comments?
It does not. Okay, great. So then let's go on through here, and we'll just go right through the report. So first, in the executive summary section, are there comments? And please identify yourself before you speak. Executive summary section, page 3.
Kevin, this is Paul. I'd say big picture, there seems to be some inconsistency between the recommendations at the end of the document in the executive summary and then the pieces that are in the middle. Anya or Stan, maybe if you could just comment on that.
Well, I'd love to know more about the inconsistencies. Some of those involve the issues around dates that I mentioned a moment ago. Some of it is simply that in the executive summary, there's an attempt to boil down a 40-plus page report into 2 pages. And necessarily, whenever you do that, you leave out a lot of details, and you try to present a fair generalization on the understanding that the interested reader will be able to go through the broader report and flesh out all the details later on. But if you could mention the specifics, Paul, that would be helpful.
But I guess it almost seems to me like the recommendations are almost an executive summary. And maybe as we go through the document, I can point out some of the inconsistencies.
Okay, so Paul, you're saying that there's inconsistency in the
I'd say concepts and words that we use to describe it.
Okay, so then any other in the executive summary, we can always touch back on that section after we get through the rest of it.
Sal Luciano, I thought the executive summary is good. I was just wondering, right before the bullet points, there's a phrase, "We recommend a policy change with the following features." It just seemed a little awkward. Policy change or clarification. It sounds like we changed something, and I'm not sure we did. On page 3, before the bullet.
Would it be easier to say we recommend a policy with the following features?
Yeah, that's fine.
Yep, that's fine.
Otherwise, I think it's really good, and whoever drafted the whole thing, I think deserves our gratitude.
Mm-hmm. That's for sure. That's Nancy. That's for sure. I agree.
Okay. Anything else in the executive summary? Okay, and let's move down to the background, beginning on page 5, overview of the legislation, the work of the committee, the committees and task forces and the board. Anyone?
Kevin, it's Paul.
Sure.
Maybe just going back to the executive summary, for me, there wasn't enough emphasis on the feasibility of the competitive option. And I'd say making the clear distinction between the leadership and management of the existing covered population, as we talked about at the last meeting, being one role, and then the second being the competitive option, and then the competitive option being subject to the feasibility, and I'd say that we discussed the criteria at the last meeting.
Okay, so you'd like just a little more detail in the executive summary that explains that, Paul?
Make the clear distinction, identifies the two primary roles and then describes what the feasibility is.
Mm-hmm. Anybody object to that?
This is Ellen Andrews. We're not talking about making it contingent on some level of feasibility, but that individuals will be able to come in on January 1st, 2014.
I'd say that fundamentally there's an assumption that there is a feasibility assumption.
Right.
And the feasibility is that the board will determine that the competitive offering is viable, that it doesn't expose the state budget to underwriting losses. And that startup costs won't increase the state's budget deficit. So I'd say there's a fundamental aspect of feasibility.
This is Bruce. I'm not sure we ever agreed that there would not be some upfront cost. In other words, if the whole process is contingent on there not being a dime spent up front. I mean, that's my concern. I agree. Feasibility, we did discuss that, and I am in agreement with Paul that obviously we have to look at feasibility as we move this forward, and I think that was part of the discussion all along. I'm a little concerned if we say, draw a line in the sand that in order to do any of these measures, there cannot be any upfront cost that might increase the deficit now for later savings. That's a tough one to get over in regard to anything we're attempting.
And this is Paul. That's not what I'm saying. I'm just saying that there, as a board, we have a responsibility to make sure that this is what we're going to do is financially prudent.
This is Jeff. I'm just following up on Bruce's comments. And perhaps I missed something in terms of reviewing the report, but we really do not articulate, perhaps we're not required to do so, what exactly some upfront costs would be or whatever, or what the General Assembly would determine they would have to look at with regard to additional costs to the state in terms of approving the continuation of the sustenance initiative. But perhaps that was not part of what this report's supposed to address.
It's Benita here. I'm not sure that is our role. I think, as I understand it, our role was really to say these are the policy changes or these are the policies that we are recommending be discussed by the legislature and approved by the legislature, and that I don't think that we have, even though I understand that there's a cost concern, that's part of our responsibility.
Ms. Salucciano, I think we're going to have to let the politics decide that. I'm in agreement with Bruce in the sense that, there may be a cost that's minimal that makes sense as an investment that will save money, even short term. So,
and there's nothing about this that's binding on the legislature.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And this is Paul. And I'll just say that the we're asking for this board to be given a lot of responsibility and a lot of authority. And I think that in this report we have an opportunity to demonstrate that what we're going to be, that the way we're going to work is going to be sensitive to the needs of the citizens and financially prudent. And so, to me, this report sets the tone.
This is Ellen again. Is Christine Vogel on the call?
I don't believe so, Ellen.
All right. Well, I don't want to speak for Christine, but I want to echo her comments from last time, reminding everyone that the advocates that and the political pressure that led to the bill was around covering the uninsured. And if I understand feasibility and political realities, and nothing's going to happen if there's not money, I get that. But for a task force to come out with a report that's already weakened really sets it sets it up to fail.
I don't know that I would agree that it's weakened, but I think it's a really important point that the negotiating, you know, I think we can say that we are sensitive and understand the financial realities. We understand the importance of having a, you know, a program and ultimately a plan that is responsible to the policyholders and to Connecticut government, and that we shouldn't negotiate with ourselves early on. And I think we're trying to find a way to acknowledge that challenge, but at the same time, you know, hold firm on some of the important issues like the one that you mentioned. And did we not hit that mark?
This is Dana. I think you know, we were very responsible in looking at the cost, in looking at the impact in terms of budget impact. I think there's a tone in the report of not just saying spend money, but really what does the investment mean for Connecticut in terms of long-term within the health reform at the nation level, the amount of funding that can become available if we do certain things. I think the tone is there. I do hear Paul's concern, but I think the prudency is in the report already in different parts. It is, to me, one of the themes of the report, not just making recommendations, but making recommendations that are sustained by research and by data and by studies.
Anyone else?
Nancy, let me just add to that. You know, I think there is a balancing act on this. I've been one that has been, I think, probably more verbal about the financial conditions of the state. But I do think at this point the recommendations that are coming out of this committee are just that. And I think whoever said we don't want to negotiate with themselves is accurate. I think they, between the legislature and the next administration, the negotiations of this will be going on with what the bottom line is. But I do think at this point, what's in this report is, you know, something that has been studied and looked at, and the recommendations out of this report, if in perfect time, is what we should be coming out with. And I think we should be coming out with it at this time, because we have to show what the road should look like to deal with the healthcare problems of the state.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, Saliciano, I agree. I mean, part of the problem is, you know, when we say how much it costs, from which pocket?
Yeah.
You know, to pretend that we're already not paying for a lot of this stuff
right.
in different ways is. You know, I'd like the ability to make that argument. And so I would say let's not us get bogged down in that.
Mm-hmm. And to presume that the report is going to go in and we're not going to have any role in negotiating with the administration or being in conversation with legislators, it's Bonita, by the way, I think that doesn't make sense. So my recommendation would be just to proceed with the executive summary, because nowhere in the executive summary does it talk about the role of the board. It talks about the reform and
right.
what it is that we have looked at over the last number of months, but that in the body of the recommendations with regard to the authority and cost, I think it's there. So what I might recommend is including something in the report that says that we are going to remain vigilant in our attention to the cost concerns as the legislature takes the report up.
And I think, this is Nancy again, I'm hoping that one of the things that Sal brought out is the fact is that when this report is looked at, it's looking at where we're going to find the savings of bringing together, the Medicaid, Medicare, mm-hmm. state employees, and pay for some of the other programs within the money that we are spending right now.
This is Paul. I'd say that I agree with everything that's been said. My specific concern relates to not the existing programs, but to the competitive options,
mm-hmm.
in that that the board really consider the implications of offering a competitive option. There are other ways to expand coverage and cover the uninsured. So that's my specific concern.
So, Paul, it's Bonita. That is in the latter part of the document, is it not?
It is, yep. And so I just say that and I think that for me, if we said in the executive summary that we're going to be careful about offering this competitive option, that would, that's all I'm looking for.
I mean, there was talk about what, feasibility study or business plan later in the document?
Mm-hmm. Yes, right.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
So can we just mirror some of that same language versus caution, just that,
That'd be great.
Reference to feasibility?
Right.
Sounds good.
Great.
All right. Background section.
This is Marie Smith. I have just a point of clarification around consistency. And there's a sentence at the bottom of page 8. It talks about what the current spend is in the state of Connecticut by the government for health care. And the one word that kind of caught my attention, because I wasn't sure it was consistent with sustenance, is including incarcerated or corrections medicine program. Is that really impacted by what we're talking about in sustenance?
No. This is Dan. That particular sentence is simply trying to say that if you look at all that the state of Connecticut does, it manages $8 billion, roughly, a year of state and federal dollars to purchase health care for multiple populations. That's the only point being made in that sentence.
Okay. I just think for consistency, I'm thinking, does that sort of plant in the mind of a reader who hasn't been part of these discussions that somehow that correctional medicine program covered by the state is somehow incorporated here, because the next sentence goes on to say how we manage these funds, making sustenance broadly. So maybe just if you're going to include it in the broader picture, say this is our big spend, if the incarcerated beneficiary program or health care program is not part of what we're talking about, maybe that just needs to be clarified.
Yeah, maybe we can put another footnote.
With all due respect, this is Nancy again. With all due respect, I hope we do check to see, look at our expenditures on our incarcerated, and look at the pharmaceuticals and everything else, because I do think that there's probably savings.
Yeah, I don't disagree, Nancy. I just wondered if it's going to start planting in the minds of the readers that sustenance is going to address that population.
Well, it may.
Yeah.
Kevin, I'm sorry. I think, Marie, is it accurate to say that by naming the incarcerated population and not some of the other smaller populations that we also provide health service for, it highlights them above others, and so do we need to say something generally after that, like, and other populations? Does that smooth over and not point out that one population?
What caught my attention was certainly knowing a little bit about what the health center does with this population for UConn. I know it's costly. So, and I don't disagree with everything that's been mentioned. It's just that it kind of isolates that population. But then later on, I'm just wondering in our projections and those sorts of things, are they taken into account? And if they are, great. I didn't think they were, and if they aren't, maybe we should talk about that as additional savings or potential additional savings with other populations or something to clarify that so that people don't believe that's part of our modeling. But if it's part of the modeling, then that's okay. I just wasn't sure that it was.
No, you're right. It's not part of the modeling.
Okay.
But that said, you know, we could certainly make a note in here about how while the incarcerated are not going to be members of Sustenance per se, that the same kinds of reforms and negotiations for better prices that would apply to Sustenance could also apply to other parts of the state's
practicing. Right. No, I think that would be great to clarify.
I mean, this is Kevin again. I would agree with Nancy that we want to leave the door open to, you know, bringing these folks in, at least on some level.
And there may be other programs that the state covers of other populations that are, you know, that you would want to apply this reform to, that you might want to specify that. One, you know, a major population being the incarcerated, there may be others, but certainly maybe pointing that out.
Okay.
This is Bruce. On page 11, last paragraph, I mean, that does address some of the issues that Paul brought up as far as the commercial coverage.
Mm-hmm.
Also, just with my parental red pen, you know, the last sentence, we believe the legislature's needs. I assume that's the legislature needs to lay down a clear marker. I mean, I'm just, unfortunately,
yeah.
I'm always the grammar guy, so.
Yep.
Yeah. And
somebody needs to be.
Yes, and there are going to be some other small copy edits like that.
No, and I understand that, and I'm not trying to, but I think as long as I'm mentioning that paragraph, I would be remiss.
Okay, any more on background? Marie, did you have more than one thing?
No, that's it.
Okay, anyone else? Okay.
You know, Kevin, maybe I'll just say, on the federal reform, I think it might be helpful to include some more on the federal reform, the impact that it's going to have on the state. I haven't looked at the report that we did back in June. Maybe that'll cover it, but Dan, maybe you can comment on that.
You mean in terms of the cost? Effects and coverage effects?
Well, I'm thinking about, I'm also thinking about the minimum medical loss ratios. I'm thinking about the transparency. I'm thinking about the oversight of premium increases, those kinds of things.
Okay. Sure, we can put in more about that if you want.
Okay, anything else on background section? Having a little technology problem here. I apologize. And I've got vacuuming. I'm in a public place. I apologize. Okay, the background sections, and then federal health care reform, and then we'll go on to the findings. That's page 9. Okay, so now findings and recommendations. Anything under covered populations beginning on section page 10?
So on 11, at the top of 11,
mm-hmm.
the interim step, we say small firms, municipalities, and nonprofit corporations. And I think I was thinking that small firms were going to come later, not as an interim step. I know that we talked about the municipalities for sure, but then the small employers and the nonprofits, I'm not sure where those fit in. I thought they were coming later.
I thought, Salvaggiano, I thought that was the feasibility, that it would come later, but if we can do it earlier, we would try to do that.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
and try to front load the municipalities, right?
Yep. Mm-hmm. And it says so in there.
Yep.
So then the language about the same coverage received by state employees and retirees, I think that is I struggle a little bit with that language because I think that many perceive the state benefits the state employees receive as not to be contemporary. And in my mind, I thought that we were going to be offering the benefits that were more like you described later, where they would be, the benefits that are offered in the commercial marketplace.
Well, this is Stan. What the report says is that in terms of serving non-municipal populations, that would be the case. But with municipal employees, where there's, you know, what we heard was the need for speed, and you know, as articulated by Sal, the need for, you know, rapid cost relief to municipalities, if at all possible. The thought was it would certainly be quicker to say, look, if you guys want to buy in, you can just buy into the existing state employee set of benefits. What the detailed recommendations say, though, recognizing that some municipalities may not want to pay for that, the detailed recommendations say that if a municipality and the authority board agree, a particular municipality could receive more commercial-style benefits.
And we're changing the delivery system, so it's not going to mirror what it is now, right? That's
right.
The big thing that we're doing to save money and to make the outcomes better. It isn't just access, and it isn't just, you know, we're changing the entire system. So that, you know, when you say the existing level of benefits, they're not going to be the existing level of benefits, but something different and better, right?
Mm-hmm.
So to me, if you just, Dan, if you took what's in the later part of the document and put it in here, I think that would feel better to me. Because I think, you know, whether you agree or disagree, I think that there's a lot of sentiment that the state employee plan is not contemporary.
We can certainly do that.
So an acknowledgement of a potential for a different benefit design going
yes.
in?
Yes, yep.
Because obviously the complication is that on the front, if we try to front load municipalities, there are going to be those who will choose to come in because of price constraints, and if they can get their own collective bargaining issues under control, they'll come in. And then when and if there's a different offering, which in my mind, and I could be wrong, sort of feels like it's part of this develop the plan licensure thing as it moves forward. There may be different options for a town, for example, that doesn't offer as comprehensive a benefit design, and maybe, in fact, we'll end up having a contemporary benefit design that's smarter and, as Sal pointed out, better.
And I think that's what Tom's been working with through the MEHIP plan.
Right. And we may want to, you know, piggyback off the existing MEHIP language for the beginning parts of this. So, and as much as we keep it aligned, it's probably a good thing from a language perspective.
You know, I think you have to also realize there are many towns that have better plans that still might want to buy in and be part of sustenance. So you do have to have that ability to negotiate, you know, with the towns to allow them to have, you know, come into the plan.
All right, I'm going to keep pushing here. Benefit section, beginning on page 14. Okay. Delivery system and payment reform section, beginning page 18. All right, governance and administration, beginning
hey,
page 20.
Hey, Kevin.
Yes.
Maybe just I'm looking at page 12. A larger population may give the state added leverage to lower prices for goods and services. And I'd say that it's not just getting lower prices for goods and services, it's getting better value.
Okay. I think, is there any objection to add something about value in there?
Sounds good.
Yep. Thanks, Paul. Okay, so I was at Governance and Administration, page 20. Moving to Coverage and Access, page 24. Prevention and Public Health Investments, page 27. Okay, so that closes the finding section. Not closes, but that we've gone through it. Now we're on to the coverage and cost estimates side. Let's do coverage first, beginning page 29. Anything on cost, page 31. Okay, now the nitty-gritty. The detailed recommendations to the General Assembly beginning on page 38. So anything on page 38 in the intro or 39, governance and location within state government?
This is Ellen. I have something on the Consumer Advisory Committee.
Okay.
I understand there was definitely a sincere discussion at the last meeting around finding a comfortable place, a safe, secure place for consumer input, and I want to support that as strongly as I can. Just having worked with consumers, though, it feels like it could be seen as put off to the side, maybe weak or marginalized, since they're in a different committee that kind of, you know, talks to the grown-ups, so to speak. If there was something stronger there, I think it would send a better signal around what I perceive to be a very strong commitment to consumer input from the board. And I have a couple of suggestions. One would be that any policy changes that change consumer cost sharing or benefit structure would have to be either approved by that group, or given that I'm probably not going to get that, we never get that, that we have something like a fiscal note that comes from that group that's public, that has to go with that policy piece into the public domain around the impact of any consumers.
I mean, Ellen, this is Kevin. I'm really comfortable with an impact statement.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what others feel.
Yeah, it's Benita here. I would echo Ellen's sentiments, and I think not only an impact statement, but I would even say that one representative is not enough, and I understand why that one representative would be included in here, because you don't want the board to be too unwieldy, but I think there needs to be some definite, clear task that's important to the overall functioning of the plan so that the consumer advisory group is not just that offside group, so impact or anything else that would really carve out a particular and important role that consumers would have.
I mean, this is Bruce. What is the role of the healthcare advocate for the state on, you know, in relation to what we do on the board?
Well, I mean,
if any.
It's Kevin. I mean, I imagine the core duties of that office would continue. So, you know, if you're getting your coverage through SustaNet or, you know, that you could still work with the consumer could work with the Office of the Healthcare Advocate to to solve problems, appeal denials, education, and then obviously there's a growing policy role for the office. Evidenced by the co-chair.
I mean, what I'm getting at is looking at sort of getting a pulse of the experience of the consumer. One is the consumer advocacy committee or whatever we're going to call it. One or two board members from that committee, you know, I could go either way. But perhaps formalizing that the healthcare advocate will somehow feed back to the board the input they're getting from the state.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as to issues with the plan, as to reactions, as to numbers of problems that they're fielding with our offerings versus other plans. I mean, is that a possibility?
Can I just get a clarification, Bruce? Do you mean instead of direct input, or do you mean in place of direct input from the Consumer Advisory Committee? Cause
oh, no, I'm saying in addition to.
Okay, because I'm aware that every board member does that.
Right, but and I would say that, you know, beyond what every board member can or will do, the Healthcare Advocates Office can also, over time, you know, produce data based on complaints and confusion and all of that and give feedback to the SustaNet board. But I agree with Bruce Mellon that it wouldn't be a replacement for direct consumer representation.
No, I mean, I'm not suggesting getting rid of the consumer representation. I'm saying that if you want to look at the how to get as much of that information in as accurate a way. One way is, you know, the consumer committee, which is a finite number of individuals, hopefully distributed from around the state, from also from different socioeconomic groups, users, they need to be enrollees, et cetera. But the other piece is looking at a more broad pulse, and I think the Healthcare Advocates Office is part of that. I don't know if we want to just
throwing it out there as
just an idea.
You want to mention that it's part of the feedback loop for the board? Is that what you're?
Well, that's what I mean. It's just as we're talking about consumer input that popped into my head.
Yeah, this is Nancy. I understand. Where you might want to include. I'd hate to see where the healthcare advocate is written in statute to report back to anybody. Mm-hmm. And that whole idea of the healthcare advocate is a advocate that stands out. I would think that if the sustenance board had done something wrong and there was complaints, the healthcare advocate would be coming to tell you about the problem and
right.
See how they can fix it. But I the whole idea of the independence of the healthcare advocate is, I think, important to all of us going in the future.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure this would decrease the independence of that group, but you know, again, I'm just saying that in some way I would want that input on a regular basis to know what's coming into that office as far as our plans, and frankly, also comparing it to input about other plans. So that we at least get some sense as to how good a job we're doing in relation to how well people are actually navigating whatever we're trying to do. But
I think, though, Bruce, this is Nancy again. I think that, and I'm sure that nobody can fill the shoes of Kevin going into this as a healthcare advocate, but I think the whole idea of the healthcare advocate, and I think what Kevin has done is every time there is a question that comes in, he or staff contacted either the insurance company or the hospitals or anything else they needed to do. But I hate to see it in statute. That's all I'm saying. I think the healthcare advocate is the person that would be telling person that something has gone wrong. But I hate to put it in statute that he or she would have to report immediately at a certain time thing or any of that.
Okay. Yeah, is the healthcare advocate position going to be part of the new board, or that's yet to be determined as well?
I mean, unless they make a change in the chairmanship of the board, it would remain. The new healthcare advocate would be the co-chair.
Okay.
I have a suggestion that might help, or maybe it won't, but this is Ellen again. Another suggestion is that a lot of consumer groups are sort of out there without any staff or with sort of people taking minutes, and that gets really hard given, I mean, I do this for a living and I get confused a lot. It's to make a meaningful fiscal note impact statement, they're going to need staff and I'll be honest, I don't mean volunteers like me. They need real dedicated staff, and maybe that could be done through the Office of the Healthcare Advocate.
You know, on that one, I feel like we might be blurring things a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But I agree with your opening statement, Ellen, that they're going to need maybe even a higher level of support to make sure that it is meaningful participation.
Right. So do you want to just put in appropriately staffed?
And independence of the staff.
And I've heard a couple of times people say maybe more than one consumer board member. any opposition to moving that to two?
No.
Okay. Ellen, did you have more things?
Oh, yeah, but not on this.
Okay. Anyone else in that governance location? I think that's where we left off.
Hey, Kevin, my computer didn't scroll as fast as you were talking. Just back on page 29 where we're talking about the Gruber model, there's already been some criticism of this, and I think if we just clarify, it'll address the concern that I've heard. But the availability of subsidies would cause a minority of firms with 100 or fewer employees to stop offering insurance, and I think we just need to be more clear on why. And the reason is that the combination of, I think it's really the subsidies that would prompt employers to direct their employees to the exchanges. Is that right, Stan?
Yeah, because if your employer offers you coverage, as a general rule, you can't access subsidies. So there, you know, if most of the companies that offer insurance today have enough higher income workers that they're not going to drop coverage, because doing that would mean that people would have to pay taxes on their health insurance. But for the minority of firms that are primarily have low-wage workers with health insurance, for them it doesn't make any sense to offer coverage post-2014. It would make much more sense to drop coverage, let your low-wage workers get the subsidies in the exchange, and use some of the savings to raise wages. So we could certainly spell that out.
In just a sentence or two, Stan?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Paul, does that get where you...
Yep, no, that's it, exactly. I just think that for somebody who isn't as familiar with what's happening, I think we may need to help them understand why employers would be dropping coverage.
Yeah,
right, because on its face it sounds like we're breaking something.
Yeah.
Or someone broke something.
Yeah.
Okay, policymaking duties and responsibilities of the board, 39 into 40. Administrative duties and responsibilities, 41. Reforming healthcare delivery and payment, 42.
Is this the part about the Medicaid panels and rates?
I'm not there. Is somebody on that page? I'm working from the...
No, that's under expanding Medicaid coverage and access.
Okay.
Yep. We're almost there.
Remind me, Stan, when we get there.
We're there.
This is Marie. I have a comment if we're on page 44 in that section.
Yep, reforming healthcare delivery and payment.
Yeah. There are some great statements that I think show the thoughtfulness and the input of the board and the subcommittees on the whole area of data systems and the need for that infrastructure to be able to look at the quality and the cost implications and all. And I'm just wondering, that will require, I think, a fair amount of infrastructure cost to either redesign or contract or whatever, given that I don't believe too many of our systems statewide now in the agencies have the ability to integrate the transaction and administrative costs with clinical data. So I'm just wondering, is there, I guess getting back to one of the very earliest points in our discussion, there was mention about the responsibility and setting the tone and of our work to give as much information to the legislature as they make decisions. So are there expectations or will there be information that we can offer around estimates for costs, around revamping data systems to accommodate all the things we're recommending in policy?
Well, so Stan, the approach taken in this report is to say that to the extent, and I'm not sure I'm totally getting the question, but in this report what it says is that to the extent new resources will be available to implement a system of interoperable electronic health records, but the report does not ask state general fund dollars to pay those
right.
costs. Instead, it says that federal dollars should be accessed whenever possible, and that SustaNet should work with others within the state to try to use leverage of purchasing on behalf of all the state's providers, use that leverage to get higher quality and lower cost goods and services. I don't know if that answers your question.
That's a little bit different than what I was thinking, Stan. That, I think, is on the provider side. But what I was referring to is like recommendations 9 and 11, which really are more about data warehousing and tracking on the plan side or on the state side and the agencies that, you know, would be involved or offices that are involved. And I know that, I don't know, can Rob Zavosky talk or is he just in a listen mode?
Please be advised, Dr. Zavosky has to leave for a 10 o'clock meeting.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, the one I'm most familiar with is the Medicaid MMIS system. And having worked with that, I know that it is very intensive on transaction data, but that current plan for, let's say, Husky enrollees would not be able to do some of the things that we're talking about in 9 or 11.
Oh, I see what you mean.
And so there obviously will be cost implications there, whether it's built within the state system or it's contracted, or and then there's the analytics piece and those sorts of things. Is the assumption made that any of those costs, which would be upfront costs to be able to have systems to carry out those requirements for data reporting and quality reporting and pay for performance reporting and those sorts of things, disparity reporting, is the assumption that any cost that would be incurred to get that up and running would come from the savings?
No.
This is Anya. Maria, we didn't quantify those costs, but I think
okay.
you make a good point. I do think one way of dealing with it is that under the federal health care reform, there's new money for states to upgrade their eligibility and MMIS systems.
Okay.
I mean, there was already money for MMIS upgrades, but the feds have given a lot more money to states to upgrade these systems, and perhaps what should be incorporated in here is some reference to taking into account these needs as the state undergoes redesign of those systems.
Mm-hmm. And knowing that there are monies that will be available, maybe not for all, but to offset that would be probably important, I would think, as somebody's considering what is this upfront cost totally for this, the recommendations that were
right.
being made.
Sal Luciano, I think it's a great question because right now, I know in a lot of places we can't get information in Medicaid because a lot of the providers consider that proprietary. But in the state side, where we look at the information, it's a wealth of information. The problem currently, though, is that because of the coding and billing, the way they do that, there's a lot of nuance to it, and so it's hard to get good information simply because the way we get it is through the payment system. You know, the payment system is attached to a code as opposed to a treatment system. So it's the new system will probably needs to take that into account in terms of getting really good, accurate information. And so that is very complicated. And I don't know if anybody's really thought that through.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And part of the whole shift to electronic health records is being able to move from claims data to clinical data.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a really good point. And I think Anya's point is really an excellent one, that is that the state is going to have to go through a procurement on for its MMIS system because it's going to be subject to new requirements under the Affordable Care Act. And so there's going to be no way to avoid at least some state costs. So, you know, Anya's thought I think is terrific, which is to say that as the state moves forward with a new procurement, it should make sure that new procurement takes into account these these needs for a data warehouse and for being able to track racial and ethnic disparities.
And maybe, this is Marie, maybe a way, a phrase that can pull that together is to look at language that's used in a lot of other HIT-type reports, and it means bringing together data sets that will give you demographic, administrative claims, and clinical data, and being able to integrate those. And I think those are the three, at least, major data sets that would need to be incorporated to accomplish the policy number 9 and 11.
That's great.
Okay, so we'll flesh that out, Stan and Anya?
Absolutely.
Great.
Stan, this is Jeff. And following up on Marie's comments, I'm not sure whether there's any reference in terms of the application of some of the systems we were just talking about with regard to trying to prove patient safety. Is there any reference to that in the document that you're aware of?
Let's see. That would be, there's number 10 in the section that we're looking about talks about reporting performance in terms of quality, efficiency, and safety.
There's also a recommendation around establishment of a safety committee.
Okay, I must have overlooked that. I just wanted to see if there was something, some reference to patient safety in the document, since that's such an important part of all the initiatives.
It appears in multiple places, Jeff, under some of the recommendations. It's often grouped together with quality, payment, and safety.
Okay.
This is Ellen. On the piece around data reporting and a data warehouse, there isn't any mention of privacy and security that I saw, and I think that's really important given things that are happening in the health IT world right now around consent, and it's going to be contentious probably during the legislative session. And I think some discussion about privacy and security would at least allow SustaNet to not fall into that miasma.
Good. We could certainly add a sentence saying that, absolutely.
Is this where I also talk about Medicaid rates?
Not yet.
Almost there. Okay, anything else on that payment and delivery section? Okay, now, expanding Medicaid coverage and access to care, page 45. Ellen.
Well, I just want to say how much I love this document. I have to say I was worried. I got to say I was very worried. But this document is phenomenal, and the language around improving Medicaid rates up to Medicare levels, which is, I think, more than fair, is phenomenal. I love that you took the basic health plan money and put it into improving rates, because I think until we do something about fair rates, we're never going to address anything more than lip service around injustices, inequities, and disparities in the Medicaid program. And I think Margaret's question in one of the meetings was really well taken, that she had always, and I had as well, that we were talking about one panel, one program for everybody, and that's probably not politically or financially feasible, I understand. But having said that, I think that maybe some strong language around getting to Medicaid rates, and maybe with a timeline on it, again, with Paul's caveats about feasibility, I understand that. But until we start making programs equitable, that a doctor gets paid the same amount to see a Husky child as he does to see mine, I think that's an important value that ought to be reflected.
Well, this is Bruce. I mean, I agree that, again, starting out in this process a year and a half ago, my sense of the process was eventually to get to a point where there was really one standard of care for everyone.
Mm-hmm.
And clearly, from a physician standpoint, you know, again, I work in a clinic, so my salary is not necessarily affected by those, you know, individual day-to-day rates. But I know, being that Connecticut is a really small private practice state, that access to care is adversely affected by the low rates. And a lot of, you know, I can't get people into subspecialists, and until we do that, it's not going to happen.
Hey, it's Margaret, and if I can just piggyback on that, I thought it was implied in here, so just correct me if I'm incorrect, that when we included the state employees and the Medicaid programs, it was one panel. You got credentialed once by one insurance subset or one panel to participate in it. Am I incorrect in my understanding on that? So if you're a provider, you're a provider for anybody that's in SUSTINET. Anybody in SUSTINET can access you, not just people on one plan or another?
Well, the report does at various points say that there are differences between existing populations that include provider payment rates. And
right, but it doesn't say different provider panels. So
well,
I'm just to clarify for me.
Well, I think it does actually.
Huh,
under
that.
under the covered population section, if I remember correctly, it says. Let me see if I can find that. Does it say that? Let me see.
I may have missed it. I didn't. I was looking for it and I didn't see that.
Let's see. There was some discussion about, I don't remember exactly where it is, about the differences between different populations and how there's some similar elements and some different elements. Let me see if I can find it. Anya, do you remember where that is, that discussion?
No, I'm just looking for it.
Let me see. Here it is. It's on, yes, in the section under covered populations, about a page before board recommendation. It's a paragraph that says there are major differences between the potential sustenance populations, including covered. Oh, no, let's see.
What page is that then?
Well, the problem is I've been taking notes inside the document, so my pages are different.
Than off. I think it begins, covered population begins on 10. How far down in that section?
Oh, you know what? Here it is. It's the very last paragraph before board recommendations. It says, put simply, much of the coverage received by these different groups will continue to differ under SUSTINET, including applicable legal requirements, funding sources, population characteristics, provider networks, and reimbursement levels. That's where it is.
So is that like seen as a permanent, that there isn't even a place where there's a goal to come to one common provider network?
That goal is not included in this report.
Okay, so let's take that up. What do folks feel about that? I mean, obviously the reimbursement rates are going to obstruct our ability in the short term to, you know, get folks into a single panel. But is that our goal? And if it is, do we want to state that together with raising reimbursements, we want to get to?
Well, maybe that's rather than the fixed goal. This is Bruce. It's our preference, or I don't know if there's a better word, because I realize the reality is that it's going to be tough to get there, but to me the ultimate vision might be to have one panel, one plan.
But you're not right. And it's Margaret. I don't think we are going to – I think it has to be a goal because we aren't going to get there. We already know that the real shortages of primary care are in rural Northeast and rural Northwest Connecticut. The health centers in those areas are not going to suddenly be able to manage the increased number of patients that we're going to have. So we are going to create, I think, our kind of worst fear, a insurance card to nowhere, if we don't have provider panels. And I think there are ways to structure this. One is you get credentialed and you're in for everybody unless you opt out, which is certainly one way of getting there. Another is to be more patient. That I usually feel like being, but more patient around saying that we anticipate that rates will ultimately drive participation. But really, if the benefits are very similar, which they are in terms of prevention with no copay, chronic disease management, all that, then the one big variable hanging out there is, can you get anybody to see you? And if the answer to that is still no, we can't get to health disparities and all those other things. So I think it has to be stronger than a preference in the plan, in the document.
I agree completely. This is Ellen. If we're going to add another 120 to 150,000 people into Medicaid, and it's already nearly, I mean, it's nearly impossible sometimes to find appointments for some of my clients, the idea that you know, we're going to do this and, it's, you know, that rates are going to stay where they are, that's besides us net or not. But if you want this to work, there has to be some discussion around coming to a provider panel that's common.
So, this is Catherine. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah.
Ah, great. I was muted all the time, I think. So I would just want to throw in a caution. I think that what I'm hearing from Margaret and Ellen is a stated goal that Cessnet ensures sufficient access to providers for all Cessnet members.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think that you want to say in legislation that the provider networks must be the same,
mm-hmm.
because you might have policy reasons in the future for having different networks for different populations. So, you know, you might want to create a, you know, for example, at some point if we have a medical home plan or something like that. Also, a lot of states are moving towards restricted networks. You know, you have a cheaper plan that has a restricted network and a more expensive plan that you can go to anybody in the state, that kind of thing. So you want to have that tool available, but you want to make sure that any benefit offered by Cessnet has sufficient access. So I think that what you're saying is that there's a goal of a sufficient network for all enrollees, but they might not all be the same.
I guess what I'm hearing about two things, this is Ellen, around just saying access, because that's what's been the, you know, theoretically the standard in Medicaid all along, and theoretically we've been meeting it, apparently, but not in the real world, not in the, I mean, if there are very few people having trouble accessing care, they must all be calling my office. I just don't think that the way we've been, certainly what that means operationally right now with sufficient access hasn't been sufficient. I think we need a new language and a new standard to hold ourselves to. And I think there's also something just in terms around an issue of justice, is everybody has access to the same group of providers. It's just an equality issue.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's going to be really difficult to erase disparities if we continue to allow, you know, the Medicaid to be the poor stepchild of the healthcare system.
Can we tie it to access in the commercial market and to say, you know, use a different measure? Ellen, do you think we can get to? Because I agree with you. I mean, you know, look, the realities for Medicaid access are what they are, and they're brutally inadequate in some cases. But if we tied it to a different standard, do you think that would get us to a better place?
Yeah, I guess. Well, there's a feeling that somehow it'd be harmful to have a goal of one panel. I'm not saying set it in statute that by 2014 every doctor has to take Medicaid. I'm not saying that. But to have a goal of one panel eventually.
What if we were to say something like a goal that all Cessnet members that Medicaid? What I'm struggling with is that your source of payment should not influence or determine the providers to whom you have access within Cessnet.
Oh, I like that.
Mm-hmm. This is Joe McDonough.
Hey,
Joe.
First of all, I mentioned before, in the commercial market, the issue is doctor availability. With state employees, I don't know, Sal can perhaps answer it. My experience in my town is that doctor networks are a part of collective bargaining. I agree with the principle of having a single network, but at some point you have to understand that if you insist that doctors must be part of all across the entire range of products being offered, have to be available to everybody, you run the risk of them opting out of everything.
This is Ellen again. I wasn't suggesting on any level, please, anybody who's listening, please, I'm not saying that we're going to make doctors do anything, because we can't lose anybody from Medicaid right now. We can't lose any primary care doctor at any level from anything. However, I would like Cessnet to be so wonderful that people are dying to get into it, and they're dying to get into all the different panels.
Dying to get in is not necessarily...
I think big, okay? And that gets back to the Medicaid rate issue, which is not the only issue, but it's certainly there.
Well,
this is Catherine again. I have another suggestion. What if we require the board to establish a standard for what is efficient, sufficient access, and it's, you know, in terms of number of, you know, physicians in each specialty with who are taking members within, you know, X miles of the member's address, something like that. That there needs to be a stronger standard of what access is, so that you have a standard, but you're still not requiring this equality across every plan.
Can that be something that also needs approval from the Consumer Advisory Committee?
Approval or impact?
Approval. That's big. This is really big.
But this is Paul. I mean, the bottom line is it's a money issue. That's the reason that there isn't adequate access, right?
Yep.
Well, that's not the only issue, no.
But it's the primary issue. If the state was paying Medicaid providers what they're paying commercial payers, this wouldn't be an issue.
Yes and no. I mean, actually, I have to write it up, but we have done a study that shows that there's a lot of other issues. But you're right, it's money issue, but then it's other things too.
And
usually administrative issues also are the big things.
Oh, it's money. It's money, it's language, it's culture, it's behavior, it's a lot of things, but it is certainly the rates are important, but I think we have to come back to this was sort of back in early recommendations and discussions, and I think it at least needs to be in there as a goal.
I'm sorry, I didn't catch that, Mickey.
It was Margaret, sorry.
Margaret, right at the end, you dropped off.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was repeating. I think it at least needs to be in there, or the goal, or it so perpetuates. I mean, really, for everybody who is focused on health disparities, we all know the research, right? It's access to high performance health systems, and unless you want to quadruple the size of the health centers around the state, which is fine with me, but unless you want to do that, I think it really perpetuates the same system that's gotten us the bad outcomes that we have, and you can't do delivery system reform if there's no delivery system for people to go to.
I mean, this is Kevin. I don't see the harm in having it listed as a goal and also adding the language that something similar to what Catherine just mentioned around an access standard, because you know there's going to be other populations who have arguably an easier time, but except in certain specialties where we have real problems. Child psychiatry comes to mind.
So, this is Paul. The potential problem that I see is more pragmatic, at least in the short term. And if you look at, think about Howard Kahn's presentation for LA Care, he has multiple HMOs that he offers. And he does that because he finds value in the competition of using different networks. And so I think that if we don't recognize that there is a value to competitive networks, then we may end up spending a lot more money than we would have to otherwise. And this is a bigger issue that has to be addressed. And I feel like it's something that the board can consider in the future. But I think if I would be uncomfortable establishing it as a goal. I'd be more comfortable just saying that we're going to have access standards.
And it's got to, I don't know how to exactly word it, but it has to be real access. Because Ellen's point is a good one. I mean, you know, the fact that a dentist might take Medicaid for a kid in Bridgeport, a kid who's from Hartford, I mean, that's not really access. Even though it is, you know, and so if we can get around that, I mean.
Yeah, I think just leaving it as, you know, there will be access standards. Well, there already are access standards in Medicaid.
Right.
And they're largely meaningless. I think it has to be more, it has to be stronger than that. And, you know, maybe not saying it's approved by the consumer group, but it's tie it to commercial levels of access. Documented levels of access. It's just something that's stronger and more concrete than just saying, you know, we're going to have access.
Dan and Anya, do you have a...
Well, what if we were to say that you know, the goal would be to provide Sustenet members who receive coverage through Husky with commercial levels of access, and direct the board to flesh out specific standards that say what that means,
mm-hmm.
And to move towards a system in which coverage through Sustenet does not impair access to providers who otherwise participate in Sustenet.
That sounds good.
Can you say that last part again?
That that part of the goal would be moving towards a system in which coverage through Husky or Medicaid does not limit a consumer's access to providers who otherwise serve Sustenet members.
That would be good.
Mm-hmm. I second that. Estela, this is Estela.
Sounds good.
Not to get too much into the weeds, but can I just clarify that it's Margaret again, sorry, that providers would be credentialed once there'd be one enrollment application on which they could select which plan they were participating in, but there wouldn't be two separate enrollment applications?
I don't know that we need to. I'd worry a little bit about being too detailed in the statute about how the board is going to operate and credential providers.
Also, I'm not sure that Medicaid law allows that, Margaret. You may know better than I, but...
Yeah, you could do it in reverse. You could enroll for Medicaid and have them at the same time be able to enroll for commercial. Sorry, I'll get off it. I think the language is too weak to functionally drive change, but I appreciate that we need to move on to get to the rest of it.
Okay, so are we comfortable with what Stan just suggested?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Anything else in that Medicaid section? Moving on to public health investments. The timeline. 47.
Oh, this is Ellen. Can I say something about the public health investments?
Yeah.
First, I want to thank you on behalf of the workforce task force for including the public health workforce of the state. I didn't recognize that as big a problem as it is until I chaired that committee, and I really appreciate that you've actually got two pieces that address that. This is something that we've actually gotten a lot of traction with and others, and I don't know if you want to include it or not, but in the life skill education in grades K through 12, you have tobacco education and drug and alcohol, nutrition, stress management. That's cool. And exercise. But adding education on rights and responsibilities and how insurance works, the risks of overtreatment, the benefits of prevention, and something around the idea that coordination of care is not rationing. Did I lose you all?
No. I think folks are thinking.
Okay. I just think something around, this is a project we've talked about at the Health Policy Project for a long time, is some my son learned how to balance a checkbook, but he has no idea how health insurance works.
So you're proposing adding health insurance? I'm sorry. Again, Ellen, what you'd like to add?
The life skills education in grades K through 12 and those life skills classes everybody gets in middle school, adding something around how insurance works, what your rights and responsibilities are, really basic stuff like when you talk to someone on the phone, write down what they said, get their name and number, the kinds of things we train consumers to do, usually after the fact, unfortunately. Things around the real danger to us of how we're being overtreated, and, you know, just questioning your provider, do I really need that extra CAT scan? The benefits of prevention and that, you know, your doctor's not just nagging you. You really should go in for your checkup. And that coordinating care through a patient-centered medical home is not the same thing as rationing. We're not, you know, there was a lot of, unfortunately, people were very sensitive to scare tactics, to be honest, during health care reform, and it would have been nice if there had been some basic understanding in the public that
coordinating care is not rationing. We're not talking about death panels. Just some more rationality to healthcare understanding.
And I'm sorry, Ellen, but I'm still not clear. Are we talking about multiple additions here, or are we talking about one statement around life skills education that includes A, B, C, et cetera, and now you're just sort of working through what would be included? And I'm sorry if I'm missing it.
Well, I don't know that any of the things I'm talking about are included in the list that you have, but I'm fine with including what I said all under, you know, health insurance skills training or health.
You could add it to on page 46. You could add it to bullet 5,
yeah.
The age-appropriate life skill education.
Ellen, are you talking along the lines of health literacy?
Yeah, well, that's part of it, yep. That would be good.
Okay, because maybe referencing it that way people might understand what you're trying to get at.
So I like the idea and think that we should include it.
Paul agrees with me?
How about that?
That's
wow.
A good thing.
Okay.
Okay, so health literacy, insurance education,
yeah.
Trying to get to a couple of things, Ellen.
Over-treatment, I don't know.
And appropriate treatment and standards of care, not standards of care, but appropriate treatment and
care coordination was the other word.
Care coordination.
Thank you. You won't fight it. Good.
All right. I see a light at the end of the tunnel, folks.
Before you go to page 47. I'm looking at the health and racial and ethnic disparities piece, and Ellen's comment made me think about health literacy at the level of linguistic and other competencies. I don't know if it's in here anywhere. I didn't notice it in any other place, but I think that there's something to be said for increasing health literacy of those populations as well.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Okay, so timelining up, Bruce.
One more. Just, again, back to 5, just to say, and other appropriate, because if you start to list, then it becomes exclusive rather than inclusive.
Mm-hmm.
I'm concerned about bone health. I'm concerned about HIV and STD prevention, all of which need to be in that life skills thing. And I don't know if we want to throw those in specifically because there'll be a food fight in the legislature from, you know, the sex ed versus the not. I mean, I have no idea.
Yeah, and why you include one versus another.
What's that?
And why you include one versus another. And why
right, so there, either you need to have a total laundry list or you just say and other as appropriate, and I'll let you guys decide whether politically it's good to have, you know, certainly HIV and those types of things in there or not in there. I mean, I just see it every day in young people, so.
Okay, so and other.
Right, as appropriate or whatever you want to. You know, I'm just saying just so they know that this is, it gives us latitude.
Okay, anything down the bottom? Timeline, conclusion? Okay. Okay, so what's your preference?
Hey Kevin, if I can.
Yeah, Paul, sure, of course.
Just things that are missing maybe, and maybe they're here, and I apologize if they are, but I think it would be valuable to have a clear statement that the state values the role that employers play in providing health insurance, and the intent of a competitive option wouldn't be to undermine that role. But we had agreed on that at the, you know, one of our sessions, so if we can just include that somewhere.
So, Anya, that was one of those monkey survey thingies, right, that folks agreed on?
Yep.
And then another is, and, you know, you guys will love this one, but commentary on the risk associated with a competitive option, and I'd say including financial risk if the option loses money, operational risk that considers the difficulty of managing and offering a competitive health plan option, economic risk if the state's insurers decide to move jobs out of the only state in the nation that offers a public option, and then the risk that a sustenance offering outside of an exchange could undermine the viability of the exchange. So some element of risk.
Can we, this is Ellen, say that language in a more neutral way? Because I think it's entirely possible that it will add to jobs in the state, that it will improve affordability and make us more business-friendly. Just an assessment of the impact on Connecticut.
So it could be, you know, kind of pros and, you know, different dimensions. I mean, one, there is the potential risk that it would have this impact, but on the other side, there's, you know, the potential that it could do this. So would that do it for you?
Well, can we just neutralize it and not go back and forth on each piece?
Right.
And they more likely hope that what this will do will add jobs
right.
and make it business friendly and, you know,
right.
do all the things
and not to mention,
positive.
Not right. to mention the harder to predict savings in terms of productivity of people not being chronically ill longer, et cetera, et cetera. So,
mm-hmm.
so I think that, again, this, for me, I think what's the most controversial aspect of this is the risk of the competitive option. So I agree that many of the things that we're going to do has a potential positive impact, but I think that the competitive option, there is a risk associated with it. And I don't know if everyone saw the article that recently where one of the state's top health insurers was quoted as talking about his concern about Sustenet and the competitive offering. And he, I think he went on to say that they had effectively pulled at least 1,000 or a couple of thousand jobs out of a state because of their unfriendly business environment. So I think it's a real concern, though.
Yeah, I mean, I saw it, but on the other hand, they had their biggest, most profitable quarter ever
mm-hmm.
in this last third quarter. So, you know, and that's while having 2.2 million less people insured because they can't afford it. So, I mean, that cuts both ways, too.
Well, I guess that I don't understand how their profitability relates to their jobs in Connecticut.
Well, because part of their profitability is they've cut workers anyway, right? In order to increase, just like a lot of corporations, in order to increase their profitability.
Well, we're not going to solve this. But I guess that at the legislative level, I'd like them to at least, Nancy, maybe, you know, this goes back to your comment that the new administration and the legislature are going to be talking a lot about these issues. And I'd just like the board to recognize that it is an issue.
But I, you know, in some ways, Paul, I really do think that that's what we've been thinking about this whole time. And maybe not talking about it, but if we can bring the cost down of health care, we can get people, you know, insured, and we can offer to business and a less expensive way of procuring health care for their workers, this can be the goal that we've been looking for. I mean, this is what we've really been talking about, is making this a better place for people, coming out with a program that, you know, is not being offered as widely as ours is going to be, and that the fact is that we're looking to save money at the same time. Or at least use the money more wisely to get more people covered is probably more to say. So I think it's, you know, I hate to see us end on a negative and not a positive, that this is what we've been trying to do, that, you know, that business, every time we talk to them, this is a priority to them to offer, you know, that they can be able to, you know, have health care available. So if we're going to end on something, I really would love to see it end on a high note, that we're hoping that this plan, that Sustenet, will bring this as, you know, becomes a business-friendly state, that it also extends health care to those people that need it and brings down costs for some of those businesses that are already giving health care to their employees right now.
This is Benita. Is there going to be a transmittal cover letter? Because I think that, you know, I think I understand that there's some benefits that are, and our hope is that there will be some benefits to what we're recommending. And yes, there are going to be some risks. So is there a way to include that in a cover letter that says our hope is, our vision is, and we recognize that there are going to be some risks, and that we stand ready to work with the legislature as this these recommendations are addressed.
I'm hearing everybody, and I would want to caution us to use the word risk because of its negative connotation, and I do agree with Nancy's statement that this is a visionary, and when you talk about vision, you know, you are aware of challenges or impacts, but, you know, you are seeing even risk in the way the Chinese see it is, you know, opportunities better ways of doing things. So I would like that to be captured, and I do understand Paul's cautionary statements. You know, I think that's wise to keep it in mind. But again, in concluding, it should be about a new vision, a new opportunity, without giving on, you know, without denying the fact that we have to look at the impact.
I mean, this is Bruce. You know, my concern is we are the land of steady habits, and any, I mean, there will be plenty that will point out any risks. I am a little bit concerned about stating it, you know, up front, you know, in the banner headline, because, you know, if we, and I said this before, if we blow this shot, it will not come again for many, many, many years. So.
Then, Bruce, I'm convinced then the risk piece should be out, and we should say this is our vision, and let's go forward.
Right.
I hate to do this to all of you, but I have a meeting with the next governor, and are we ready to vote, or I don't mean to rush it, but
I am.
I'd like to, so it sounds like there isn't a support for the caution pieces that Paul laid out, but rather a vision statement of where we'd like to be. And we are at the bottom of the document. So are folks ready?
Yeah, I'll move to adopt.
With the changes?
With the changes.
Yes, second.
Okay, so what I have for voting members are Paul, Estella, Bonita, Joe, Jeff, Bruce, Sal, Nancy, myself. Did I miss anybody who's voting? Okay, I'm going to go up the roll call.
Hey, Kevin, before we do that, so we're not going to have a chance to see a final document before we vote?
Well, we could. I mean, I think the motion now is to transmit with the changes discussed. We could make the changes, send them back out, leave a 24-hour comment period, or we can include that
with
the motion.
That would be my preference.
I would move that we vote today. I think, you know, we have approved none of the suggestions are change the document in any fundamental way. And I think, you know, having to do another conference call, it's complicated. So, I think the report is excellent, and it really has captured the discussion, the sense, the spirit of what we have expressed and the specifics also.
So I'm hearing, Estella, that you prefer not to have a further comment period, but rather go right to a vote.
Exactly.
I think we do it motion as amended, and I mean the motion to accept as we've amended it.
Right.
And it's okay for somebody to look at it if they have questions and think, you know, it isn't amended or whatever. And then we shouldn't have another meeting unless it's really contentious that something's out there, and then we'd have to come back. But otherwise, it's as amended.
Mm-hmm.
So unless something in the editing completely mischaracterizes or misrepresents conversation, in which case we'll have to have an emergency meeting.
Right.
Well, and we have recent experience with that, where the minutes didn't reflect the conversations that we had.
Right. Just one so far. In defense of staff, just one.
Okay.
All right, so that's the motion as amended, that we're voting to finalize as discussed today, and absent some major mischaracterization of the discussion, in which we'll have to have an emergency board meeting, it is final.
Yes.
At the motion before us.
Yes.
Yes.
Your second.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Second, Nancy.
Second by Wyman. Okay. Ready, Sal?
Aye.
Bruce?
Aye.
Jeff?
Aye.
Joe? Joe McDonough? Bonita?
Aye.
Stella?
Aye.
Paul?
No.
Wyman.
Aye.
I vote aye. So I have one abstention, it would seem, or one absent, one no, and the rest aye. Is that correct?
Yes.
Can I just say one thing, and to all the consultants, to everybody, I want to thank you very, very much for all the work that you've done. I do apologize. I really do have to run, but I wish you all a happy and a healthy new year, and thank you all very, very much. This was quite a job, and you really came up to the best that anybody could expect. Thank you very, very much.
I agree.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I'm just trying to get back to our agenda. So, future meetings. I think we've been meeting on the third Wednesday at 9, is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Is it fair to put that third Wednesday on your calendars for at least the first quarter of 11?
Okay.
So that would be the 19th?
I'm sorry, Sal, I don't have a calendar in front of me.
That would be the 19th, the third Wednesday.
Okay, so the 19th and then the third Wednesdays in both February and March, we may need to have a special meetings or conference calls depending on what happens with the legislature.
That's the 16th of February and the 16th of March.
Thank you, Sal.
And what is the date in March, Paul?
16th.
Okay, and the 15th of February?
I think it was the 16th also of February.
Okay, thank you.
It's the way it turns out. February is exactly 28 right. days.
Okay. Thank you.
All right, well, I echo Nancy's comments. This was a great process. I think it's a document we can all be proud of.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously the work is just beginning. But I thank you. It's been an honor to work with all of you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.
Entertain a motion to adjourn.
So moved.
Mm-hmm.
So moved second.
Second. Yep.
We are adjourned. Thank you.
Happy New Year, everybody.
Happy New Year.
All right.
Bye-bye. Bye.